Howdy do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Mac Observer's Daily Observations podcast. It is Wednesday, June 26th, 2019. I am your host, Kelly Gamont. With me today, I have Andrew Orr. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, we're only halfway through the week now.
Halfway. What a week, huh? Andrew, it's Tuesday. It's Wednesday. All right. So, also with me today, I have friendly neighborhood robot, John Martellaro. Hi, John.
Good morning, Kelly.
I'm glad you're with us today. John, I actually wanted to start with you. You wrote an article yesterday about Catalina. And Catalina, which is the newly announced and currently in public beta version of macOS. A very scary public beta, by the way. If you are not interested in living on the edge, don't go anywhere near this. Let me put all the warnings around it. But you wrote about an interesting change coming to the boot volume with the new version of macOS.
Yeah, it all starts, and it's kind of a sequential story, so let me kind of lay it out, lay the landscape out. It all starts with this concept of writing code that doesn't check the boundaries of arrays. And a long time ago, hackers figured out how to exploit the fact that some code doesn't check array boundaries. And a feature of the operating system is that if you can overrun the array boundaries and step into uncontrolled code territory, you can insert your own code. And in the old days, before El Capitan, you might be able to do that to escalate your privilege to root, and then you could modify the operating system to disguise the fact that you've changed things and the user is none the wiser. Scary stuff. Mm-hmm. So just about all the CVEs you see nowadays, not all of them, but many of them still involve array bounds checking and array overflows to escalate privileges. So with El Capitan, Apple introduced this protection where the root is no longer able to modify anything on the computer. System integrity protection was introduced, and it restricts root user account and limits the actions the root can take. So now that's a step forward towards protecting the integrity of the operating system. Nevertheless, there's an article at Eclectic Light Company by a developer who catalogs exotic ways that people have been able to bypass system integrity protection despite its design. There have been ways to bypass it. And so Apple's response to that is to take the next step and to move the operating system into a protected volume where it's read-only. Mm-hmm. And so now not only do you have no privileges to modify the operating system, but even if you thought you did and you escalated your privileges, you wouldn't be able to get to or modify any system files.
Right. Now,
so that's what's coming in Catalina. Now, this won't have any effect on you, the user.
Right.
Even though there's been split out to a user container or volume, a user volume and an operating system volume within a container.
Well, I will say that we know of. We just haven't seen anything yet.
I don't know if it's two containers or not yet. I haven't had a chance to look. But anyway, it takes advantage of the APFS design, as Mike Bombeck, the developer of Carbon Copy Cloner, describes it, so that you have an operating system that is pretty much impervious to being modified by malware.
Now, I will say that we haven't seen issues with this yet. I'm sure we will. I don't know what they'll be. But something like this that always seems like a good idea always ends up with some sort of unintended consequence.
Of the unintended consequences is that HFS plus volumes can no longer be used for Carbon Copy Cloner because of the structure of the split out. HFS just does, as a file system, HFS plus just doesn't support a bootable volume for Catalina. So HFS is pretty much dead, and so Carbon Copy Cloner will have to be modified, and that's what Mike is doing this summer.
Okay.
To get it ready.
Thank you, Mike.
Prepare to abandon HFS plus completely when you move to Catalina.
Okay.
Except for, and this is a topic I'm not briefed on yet, but I assume that there'll come a time when Time Machine no longer supports HFS plus either, but that's a horse of a different color.
Well, I wonder how that migration will work, right? Like, the first time you back up, like if you still have Time Machine running and you do a an in-place install and you don't wipe everything of Catalina, you know, you go to the App Store and it says Catalina on everything. So you click the upgrade button and you wait a couple of hours and you come back and your computer's upgraded. What's going to happen the first time that computer tries to back up to that Time Machine volume? I'm going to be very curious to see how that migration works. That's one of the...
Yeah, I haven't read up on that. Yeah. I predict that eventually Time Machine, a modified Time Machine 2 will come out that works with APFS in terms of checkpoints.
I think if they're going to phase it out, I think it's going to end up having to be the way they did other stuff. So in Catalina, you will get a warning that it doesn't work. And then in whatever comes after Catalina, it'll just go away. It will actually be broken. Much like we're doing right now with the macOS version of Bitpocalypse, where 32-bit apps quit running on iOS. And if you tried to launch it, it would say that this isn't going to work and you have to get a new version from the developer or whatever it is. And we're seeing that on macOS. So if you're running Mojave, occasionally when you launch an app, it may tell you, this is a 32-bit app and the developer needs to update it or it's not going to run on the next version of macOS. And that next version of macOS has gone into public beta, which is Catalina. So if you have apps that are 32-bit apps, if you know that they are or you know that you've seen this warning, proceed with caution. And when you upgrade to Catalina in the fall, if you are interested in upgrading to Catalina before it is officially released and it's a beta, I would say now is not the time to do that.
I always tell users to make a list of the mission critical apps and then go to the developer's website for each one of those and find out what the status of Catalina support is.
Yes. For example. And right now, I would bet you money that whatever app that is not supported at the moment because developers have only had the beta less than a month. I think we're at like 3 weeks now. And one of those weeks was spent in California learning all the stuff they needed to know about the new version of macOS. So they haven't had long to get the updates out. Obviously, don't install it on your daily driver. I personally have a rule called the Star Trek movie rule of betas, which is only bother with the even numbered ones. So I never install beta one. John, I think you can back me on this. I have glanced through the release notes for the public beta of Catalina, which is out yesterday, I think. And first of all, if you are on the public beta program because you are testing versions of Mojave, it may give you Catalina. So you might want to turn that off if you have it set automatically so that you don't come in one morning, turn on your computer, and have a completely different OS staring at you. Also because there's some gigantic... holes in it that are very, very dangerous places to be.
Yeah, one of the problems, it seems to me, from my recollection of these early betas is authentication issues. Multiple attempts to authenticate through password. macOS seems to have that funny feature that early betas always seem to have that authentication issue in my memory.
Yeah, authentication is a big one that's sort of weird. And then there's other things like there may be something vital in a program that you use all the time that simply doesn't work. You know, exporting a particular file that's a really important part of your everyday workflow may not work in Catalina. And it may not be high enough on the developer's list to be updated at this point because they're looking at base level functionality. Developers are basically giving up their entire summer to make sure this stuff works when Catalina is released. Right now, it's not released. So if you want to send a note to a developer about a thing that isn't working, go ahead and send it, but please be nice and understand that this is basically what they're spending all their time on right now. So it is a priority, and if you have something that doesn't work, maybe send a note, but don't expect very much especially out of the public beta.
It's easy when you have say an old iPod Touch you want to install a beta on if it supports iOS 12 or 13. Or maybe an old iPad mini, like Jeff Gamet would do that. And you put iOS 11, 12, 13 on it or whatever, and you can mess around with it and kind of explore it. And if something goes wrong, no big deal. But on a Mac, you know, you've got your Time Machine drive, you've got your other backup drives, you've got mission critical work. You know, you have to be very careful and install on an external drive. And walk through it very delicately. Never install a beta on your internal drive of any Mac that you use regularly for anything.
So I'm assuming this is where Andrew says, I have the beta of Catalina on my laptop.
Actually, no, I don't. I'm staying away from Catalina for now, at least, and I just have iOS 13 and iPadOS.
Yeah. And that's where I'm at. I have iPadOS on an iPad Air 2, and for now, that's about it, because that was the one, because I waited for it to go beta 2, and now that it's beta 2, I can play around with it and see what we're getting out of iPadOS, because that was one of the things that was really interesting to me in the keynote. So that was definitely one I wanted to play with, partly because of the shortcuts stuff that's coming with iOS 13. I'm pretty excited to see what that's going to look like. So the other thing I want to stress this is that if you are on the public beta program on your Mac, make sure that you turn off automatic updates, because it sounds like Catalina is trickling out on the public beta update channel. And so if you want to make sure that doesn't happen, turn off automatic, and then you can at least go see and decide for yourself if you want to have those updates installed. That's a very good way to go if you decide you need to install a beta on a computer that you have sitting around. You might want to do that. It's a little harder to have test machines when we're talking about Mac OS than it is, you know, a couple $100 for an iPod Plus, an iPod Touch that you can go install an operating system on so you can get a good look at it. So that's today in beta advice, I guess. If you have it and you have experience with specifically with Mac OS, we definitely want to talk to you if you've been playing around with Catalina. And if not, if you want to tell us about your experience with iPad OS or with shortcuts on iPad OS or anything with iOS 13 that has been interesting to you, if you have it installed, obviously not on your daily driver, then you can get a hold of us at observations@macobserver.com, at TMO Daily on Twitter, or by leaving a comment in the show notes. Now, the other thing,
email us about shortcuts on the new OSs, because I've run into a couple of problems where I had to rewrite some of my shortcuts. So that's fun.
Yes. And there's some stuff with shortcuts happening that we probably want to talk about. So also, if you have cool shortcuts that you use, I will derail a tiny bit. We definitely want to see those. I'm very interested in those, because I think iPadOS is going to send me pretty far down the shortcuts rabbit hole. And so you will probably hear a lot more about that here, particularly as the betas get more usable and there's more stuff that I'm able to do with shortcuts. We're definitely going to talk about it. So that said, I also want to talk about something that, Andrew, you wrote up this morning about ISPs and how much money they spend lobbying.
Yeah, so this person over at Comparitech made this list of the top 25 ISP lobbying spenders in 2018. Now, at the top, we have AT&T, who spent almost $16 million. Down at the bottom, we have CenturyLink, who spent $85,000. And to compare it a bit further, in 2018, Apple only spent about $6.7 million. And unfortunately, I don't seem to be finding anything on what actually they're lobbying for.
Yeah, it's really hard to tell.
Just how much money they're throwing at politicians.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be everything from donating to a campaign so that a person, you know, and telling a person, like, this donation is contingent on you voting a particular way on something that I like or don't like and want to have happen or not happen. And, you know, everything from that to paying for people to go take meetings with members of Congress and talk to them, like, this is why this is important to us as an ISP. This is why that matters. This is why, you know, this is why that bill should pass or shouldn't pass, or why there should be a bill that legislates this thing, is because we want it to happen or we want to make sure it doesn't. There's a lot of that that goes on as well.
A lot of it is education congressional staffers about the ins and outs of both the technology and the politics of the situation and competitive issues.
Yeah. Lobbying takes many, many shapes, is what we're saying.
And Apple only spent that much because Tim Cook is just going straight to the top and talking to Trump.
Yeah, now that Yeah, it seems like that's the more efficient way to do it, so they don't have to lobby Congress anymore.
Well, one has to wonder how much information that Cook briefs Trump on is intelligently conducted to Congress, transmitted.
Yeah.
Right. But there's also a certain amount that maybe, like, Apple, for example, doesn't have to lobby about. I see here that it says Facebook spent $12 million last year. And that's presumably, at least a portion of that, is because Facebook wants to get their way on things and, like, not be broken up and not be super regulated and not be scrutinized over all this stuff and not be penalized for all the crap that they do that we talk about here. So there's, like, that one makes a certain amount of sense. Pandora didn't even spend $1 million last year. Spotify, right there, right under $1 million. So it's interesting to see kind of where, like, how much money these companies are spending. So, mm-hmm. you know, particularly given Alphabet, which is Google's parent company, spent $21 million last year lobbying Congress for something. Netflix spent $800,000. Dropbox spent $700,000. So there's some interesting numbers there. I'm pulling all these numbers from a website called opensecrets.org. Open Secrets is a nonprofit organization that just tracks money and then reports on it. Here's how much money these people spent at this time, etc. So it's usually not too big a deal. Like, they don't have any agenda in putting this information out. They just want to make sure people have it. So it's interesting to see the internet. But Andrew, you were talking specifically about some aggregated numbers.
Are you talking
since
about
1998?
Well,
yeah.
Yeah. Since 1998, the top five lobbying spenders were AT&T, Verizon, Comcast, Sprint, and Deutsche Telekom.
Uh-huh.
AKA Deutsche. T-Mobile.
Deutsche.
Yeah, Deutsche.
Oh, Deutsche.
Yeah.
Yeah, so since 1998, AT&T spent $341 million. And down at the bottom, Deutsche was $69
million. Mm-hmm.
Now, back in April, I did write an article about tech companies lobbying, and mm-hmm. we did get some information on what they were lobbying. So the top thing that they were spending lobbying money on was tax stuff. Mm-hmm. To no one's surprise, Apple spent the most on privacy at 45%.
Mm-hmm.
And this was, let's see, since 2005. So the number that I got was between 2005 and 18, Apple spent $60 million on lobbying.
Mm-hmm. So that doesn't seem like a whole lot of money to me. I mean, it's a whole lot of money as a number, right? But also seeing that Alphabet spent $21 million last year, Amazon mm-hmm. spent $14 million last year, that becomes a much, like, overall, you know, Apple's not spending all that, a whole heck of a lot of time and money and resources lobbying. So yeah. I thought that was an interesting.
Yeah, another figure they said is that since 2011, yearly spending on lobbying across all ISPs hasn't strayed below $72 million.
Mm-hmm.
So far, 2018 was the biggest lobbying year for them.
Yeah, and some of that is, you know, regulation, like you were talking about taxes. There's also lobbying so that people will be for a merger or against a merger. You know, I don't want to make it so that some smaller company has all the same advantages that I do, so I'm mm-hmm. going to lobby against that. Or you know, mergers, like we've seen a lot of Sprint T-Mobile merge stuff that's been, like, news, you know, going around about that. That's probably another thing that gets a lot of, you know, lobbying and stuff. And
yeah.
And in some of these cases, it may not be just straight to Congress. It may also be on a local level. Like, if Oregon was going to pass a law about something, or Colorado was going to pass a law about something, you know, AT&T is going to be there with a checkbook to make sure that it goes the way they want it to. So there, you know, there's a whole lot of layers of lobbying, I guess, that go into that. So I can see where it would be very easy to spend a whole lot of money if you have to go to a bunch of different states and you have to go to Congress and you have to talk to all these people, convince them of things. Yeah. I don't know, take them out to dinner or whatever. I don't know. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not quite sure how all of it works. But there's, you know, in order to make sure that your voice is heard, like, that's always going to take a certain amount of money. So it's interesting to see how much this has been. Like, since 1998, so 20 years of data that they were talking about, I noticed AT&T has spent $341 million in 20 years lobbying in whatever shape that takes again.
Mm-hmm.
So...
did you ever find how much the oil companies were lobbying?
Let me see here. There is an industries. Last year, oil and gas totaled was $125 million. And okay. Number one was ExxonMobil with 11. Just over $11 million. Chevron is at 9.6. BP is $5.2 million. So compared to... Alphabet, again, $21 million, $21.7 million. So $10 million more than Exxon.
Part of the problem that occurs to me is that as we try to deal with certain issues around the health and safety of our planet, that there's a lot of research being done about impacts of CO2 emissions and greenhouse gases and deforesting of the rainforest and so on. But that's being done by people who don't have a whole lot of money mm-hmm. and are, in effect, getting handout money from the federal government. And they don't have big bucks like ExxonMobil and AT&T
right.
to spend on informing Congress. So the problem is that the technical point of view that needs to be presented to Congress is washed out by the money of big companies that are making a lot of money.
Right.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's part of where I think the reporting comes in handy, because you can at least see, you know, in black and white, like, this is how much money these people are spending to tell Congress that, you know, whatever they're telling Congress or whatever they're telling people on a local level, you know, let's tell local legislatures that alternative energy is a terrible idea. And we're going to spend a lot of money to make sure that they know that's what we think. And, you know, there's the thing that was interesting to me about this was the amount of money generally given the amount of policy or legislation that I personally see coming out of that, which is usually not very much, which is part of why it was surprising to me that it was this kind of money.
Yeah.
Like, aside from the net neutrality stuff, which we see on the regular, you know, it comes and goes and comes and goes. Aside from that, I haven't seen, like, I haven't seen a lot of policy in my state. I haven't seen a lot of policy in the Northwest. I haven't seen a lot of national policy or legislation or anything that comes out of all of this lobbying. So that's part of why I was surprised about the amounts of money that were spent, because I'm not sure what they're getting for that. Unless it's just,
makes you wonder,
don't talk about that bill.
Money is going
exactly
into whose pockets?
Yeah, and you know, that's what we always tell people on this show. Go ask some questions. Go see what you can find out. Be a little bit skeptical. You know, the April Fool's Day rule of news. You know, why is it that way? How come that's what it's doing? So if we do find out, absolutely. We will tell you, and if it turns out Apple's spending a bunch of money on something, lobbying on something in particular, we will absolutely tell you about it. And with that, I think we're going to go ahead and call it for today. John, thanks for coming by to talk to us about Catalina.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And I look forward to hearing what your install experience is like, particularly as it regards Time Machine. Because I'm sure that's going to end up being a whole other process. And I'm very interested to see how that goes.
Yeah, I continue to watch that.
Andrew, thanks for coming by today.
Thanks for having me.
ISPs lobbying money. That's always an interesting topic. I've been your host, Kelly Gamont. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. In the meantime, be excellent to each other.